in with some scientific basis and some facts we're going to throw at you as well as the personal experiences that we all have had with the healthcare system. I have a list. I don't know if we have enough of these to go around, but these are a list of some books and some comments that I have about reading material. So if we can kind of pass those around, and we can get some more. And on the back side is a kind of a brief summary of what's going to happen with the healthcare reform year by year. There's a lot of confusion about what that is. I don't know whether we'll have much time to spend to really to talk about that, but at least get that information out, and that may raise some questions for our session. Thanks to Jim here, we have added another session tomorrow night, which is just going to be a very informal session here. Nothing prepared, just open discussion for anything we want to talk about that relates to medicine, however tangentially to medicine. That includes any personal issues you want to bring out or experiences you've had with the healthcare system, or if we want to talk about healthcare reform, we can talk about just about anything tomorrow night. There are two books that are on your list that I would recommend. One is somewhat outdated. It was written in the mid-90s by Sherwin Nuland. It's in the bookstore. It's called How We Die. It's a great book if you don't know much about medicine. You just want to get a feel for what happens to us as we age and die. Sherwin Nuland is an emeritus professor of surgery from Yale, and he kind of goes through his life experiences. As I say, it's a little bit outdated. There's a few things in there that I don't agree with, but basically it's a good book. If you want to know something about the healthcare system that we live in, and healthcare reform, and the direction we should go, and what we can learn from other countries, I strongly recommend this book. This is the last one on the list. It's by T.R. Reid, and it's called The Healing of America. This is really a well-written book. And he goes to many different countries. He has a bad shoulder. He goes to different countries and sees how they would treat him in different countries, what it would cost, how they would be paid for. It's and he draws some fascinating conclusions, and we will be using some of his experiences in the discussions that we have. This has nothing to do with my talk. It's just they're cute little animals, but they. I have a personal experience just to connect these little animals to healthcare. They're cute little animals. They live under houses and things. They do transmit a disease, and the disease is relapsing fever. It's an uncommon. It's called Borrelia. It's called by a little spirochete, and these animals have it. Ticks bite the animals, and then ticks bite the people. And I had the experience in 1975 of having been living. I spent a week in a cabin in Sun River in Central Oregon at a cabin with some friends. I didn't even know I got bitten by a tick, but I did. These are the soft ticks that bite and drop off at night. And it's a terrible disease. You have these horrible fevers and chills and sweats and everything. So I'm, however cute they are, I know from a personal experience that they do. There's only like 20 reported cases in Oregon, and maybe 30 or 40 reported cases in Washington State. So it's not a very common. It's a rare disease, but it is a disease. But they are cute little guys. Here's Holton Village, and there's no better place to try to bridge the gap between the scientific cultures and the natural world and the spiritual world than is Holton Village. This is what we're going to talk about. We're going to have five sessions, and they're each one stands alone, but there's also some interconnection between them. The first one is going to be a kind of a personal, regional, national, and world views of health and healthcare. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock, we're going to talk about successful aging. I think the Elder Village group here is a group that has aged successfully, so I think we have a lot to share with each other about some kinds of things that we can expect as we get older. The session on Wednesday is more of a PowerPoint kind of presentation. It's going to have a lot of, we're going to look at the literature of medicine from the point of view of medicine, of how spirituality, religion, and health interact, and the role of intercessory prayer. So I think that might be of considerable interest to some of us. And then we're going to, the last two sessions, we're going to kind of talk about medical ethics, some of the ethical dilemmas that we face today, and end-of-life issues. And the whole issues about ethics and fairness and equity and justice in medicine will weave itself through all of these discussions, and at least I hope that they do. What are we going to do today? This is what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about some definitions about health and healthcare. We're going to look at some national and international perspectives. We want to see if there really is a best system of healthcare. We'll look at determinants of healthcare, the organization of healthcare, and different models across the globe. And then we're going to say, how can we achieve the goals of universal coverage, high quality healthcare, and containment of costs? And we're going to see why especially the cost containment part is of critical importance when we actually look at what the goals of healthcare should be, or what the goals of society should be in terms of promoting health. And I'm going to tell you, for those of you who want to get out right now and leave, I'm going to give you my conclusions at the beginning. So you can take my conclusions, and anybody that wants to enjoy the sunshine, because that may be better for your health than sitting in a crowded room, where it's dark and dingy in here. So number one conclusion is that health care is not health. And this is going to come up over and over and over. So let's not confuse health care with health. And so when we're trying to promote health care and get health care for everybody, that's really not, it ought not be the goal in itself. The goal in itself is to promote health in the society. And health and wellness, what we want to achieve, have many determinants. Health care is just one of those determinants, and I kind of look at it as five determinants for what promotes health. These are my conclusions, this is not my lecture. One is genetics. I think we all know that if you have really healthy parents and they live to be 98 years old and we're still smoking and playing tennis and running around, you know that's a good thing to have. Second thing is the socioeconomic status that you find yourself in, and that it makes a huge difference to health. And that may be very well the most important determinant of health. The third is environmental. Clearly, one of the most ill populations right now, or the least healthy populations, is the Pakistanis that have been displaced by flood. That's an environmental catastrophe. They've had war, they've had terrorism, and now they have this huge flood that displaces millions of people. Disease is rampant. Everything, the whole society is kind of falling apart around them. The environment there plays a huge role on health. And finally, behaviors are really important. Personal behaviors, whether obesity, smoking, lack of exercise, those kinds of things. Healthcare itself is the fifth, and of all those determinants, healthcare is actually, when people have tried to look at this, is the least important determinant of health. It probably accounts for about 10% in terms of longevity, disability issues, things of that sort. So when we concentrate everything on healthcare, we're missing the boat. When you look at data on longevity, life expectancy, it was following a course that was increasing long before we did anything scientifically as far as medicine goes, long before antibiotics, long before anesthesia, long before surgery. And what was it? It was we were improving the environment, we were improving the socioeconomic status of the population, we were providing clean water, we were providing sanitary services. All those kinds of things were far more important than anything that medicine added to it. Now, medicine is adding something right now. It adds a lot of things, a lot of negative things as well as some positive things. But what it's adding is just working around the fringes of things, extending life at the very extremes. And what we really would need to concentrate on is how we minimize premature or early death and disability. Those are the kind of things that healthcare ought to be doing, not necessarily adding 2 months to someone's life with complex chemotherapy when they're 75 or 80 or 90 years old. And we do a lot of that. So that's number two. Health has lots of determinants, and healthcare is not health. And then number three is kind of a corollary of that. Again, it's still my conclusions. It is possible for a country to spend too much on healthcare. And if healthcare only accounts for 10% of health, if you're putting tremendous amount of resources into healthcare, you may be neglecting other resources. So education, the environment, all these other kinds of things, public safety, which affect health, affect longevity. And if you're neglecting the environment because you're promoting economic inequality in society, so you have an increase in poverty while you're pumping tons of money into healthcare mainly for the elderly, you may not be helping the population at all. It may be a detriment. So it's possible to spend too much. And maybe the United States is spending too much on healthcare. And we have to kind of look at it, and are we responsible for that individually? Are we greedy because we want more and more for ourselves, and that's not necessarily good for the society as a whole? Number four is that healthcare in the United States is unique. That's healthcare. Now we're talking about not healthy. The provision of healthcare in the United States is unique amongst industrialized countries in the world. We are different from everybody else. Now we like to think that we're better than everybody else. And we'll talk about that. All industrialized countries, all of the major industrialized countries, have a healthcare system that, number one, has universal coverage, has common care, common type care for everybody, has a non-profit system, and has regulation for quality and cost control, except the United States. We have a system that's unique and different from every other country. And the final conclusion is our healthcare reform, all that stuff that went on in Washington, D.C., last year, and led to the signing of the healthcare bill in March of this year by President Obama, has really done almost nothing to really change the way healthcare is being provided in this country. It's tweaked the edges, and it's not what it's not the end of the world. Armageddon, I think the Representative Boehner said this was Armageddon if we pass this. How many have noticed a huge change since we passed that legislation? You know, I mean, you can't find, I mean, minimal change. And there's not going to be a huge amount of change, and you have what some of the changes are. Nor is it the answer to all the healthcare woes that we have. It clearly is a step in the right direction, but it is a baby step. And so that's what, those are my conclusions. So if anybody gets up and walks out now, that's fine. I won't be personally hurt. Yes, Jim?
Cliff, would you just repeat that one statement? I didn't get it all. Where all the other industrial countries provide universal common...
They have universal coverage. They have a common system for the, for the whole population.
And cost.
Many of them have, we'll get into this, but many of them have insurance, have private insurance companies, but they're all non-profit. They're all non-profit. They're run like, almost like charities in a way. Okay. Like they're non-profit agencies. And there's lots of regulation by the government. Okay. All right, health. I'm open to suggestions. Who knows what, or who thinks they know what health is? Anybody, raise your hand, and I wear hearing aids because I don't hear, especially women when they talk in high-pitched, soft voices like Gay. At last, I just tuned her out. go ahead. So speak clearly and loud. Yes, what's health?
I love God's definition, the shalom, total well-being.
That's not
just personal health for me. It touches some of the other issues that you put in terms of majoring in minors.
Very, very good. Total well-being. Any other thoughts about what health is? Or is that it?
I think like functioning naturally. You know, like we're so unnatural in our society today with almost every way, with the food we eat, with the sleep we get, with the way we work, with the way we vacation and don't vacation. So if we could change all that and function naturally, how we're designed to.
So it has a certain almost self-healing, self-maintaining.
More preventative than, yeah.
How about absence of disease?
That's excellent. That goes with the total well-being, and one can't have a severe disease and be healthy. Or can you? Can you have diabetes and be healthy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you can. But that so that would say you know you, it's how you adapt to things. That is how you adapt to disabilities or to limitations.
Right. And that's why I think health too often is defined physically by people, and mental health is every bit as important, and Paul Ralston from Our Good State really worked on trying to get that recognized as equal insurance benefits for mental health as physical health.
Well, I'll give you some, that was good there, but I give you a few of the definitions that that have been used. Princeton University came out with a healthy state of well-being free from disease. WHO. Was the World Health Organization has a definition that they accept, and they say it's a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So, complete physical, mental, and social well-being. Well, that really starts encompassing things. Now you can see it isn't absence of disease. I mean, that's where healthcare may play a role, but. Complete physical and social, spiritual well-being. I mean, you're not going to get that necessarily in the local clinic or the local hospital, and you shouldn't expect that from them. This is, I'm not sure where this one is from, but it's, it says, health is a resource for everyday life, not the object of living. That's kind of interesting. It's a positive concept emphasizing social and personal resources as well as physical capabilities. So it's much greater than just the absence of disease or functioning at the absolute highest level. I mean, at a level of a marathoner or something like that, because we all have various limitations and disabilities that may limit us. Another term here was the true health is a state of wholeness where all organ systems of the body function at optimum levels 100% of the time. Maybe I'm trying to achieve too much. So I suspect that even with Viagra that may not work. All right, enough of that. I have a wife here trying to put limits on what I'm allowed to say here.
What's Viagra?
You obviously don't need it. All right. When we talk about medicine, sometimes it's useful to think in terms of metaphors of medicine. This is in deference to Jim Bodine here. He teaches the poetry and writing. So one metaphor for health or the lack of health or loss of health is the personal inadequacy, and that is he lost his health, or someone has lost their health, and that kind of maybe goes in with the sermon last night about losing things, and that's searching for one's health again. Another is that we're being punished by the gods, so someone is stricken with illness, or they have a stroke. Struck down, not only a god might do that, the devil might do it, and one of the terms for pleurisy, pleuritic chest pain, which is a sharp pain when you take a deep breath, is the devil's grip. You got the grip. Now, grip has also become the kind of used throughout, to be an intestinal grip, but what it derived from was the term the devil's grip. The devil with his long claws has you, and every time you take a deep breath or move, you have this pain. So there's some beautiful metaphors in the history of medicine. The military metaphor is largely what we use now. Everything is, you have a heart attack, or you have invasive cancer, it's the war on cancer, it's the winning the fight against cancer or whatever. The physician is the fighter. We use in medicine, we use the term armamentarium all the time. you know, we have different things in our armamentarium. You know, we have drugs and radiation and chemotherapy and all this kind of surgery. And that's all, they each part of the armamentarium. So it's an interesting metaphor for medicine and what we're doing. And none of this got much to do with health. It's all got to do with, you know, doing something about things.
You have 1 minute.
time goes by fast. You know, it just flies. So metaphors are kind of interesting, and Jim probably could expand on a lot of that for you. Okay. Determinants of health. You know, what determines health? And from this, we're going to sort of go into measuring health and then looking internationally. So let me just briefly talk about the determinants of health. I mentioned them before. I'll mention them again right now. That's part of my conclusions. Number one, genetics. Genetics plays a huge role in health. And we are finding out as time goes on that it's more and more. God, we just turn out like our parents, you know. And it's discouraging, isn't it? But there is just a huge genetic component to our lives, to our physical. I mean, people talk like their folks. They walk like their folks. I mean, it's just amazing. And they get very similar diseases. So genetics play a really, really key role. The social circumstances and the social economic status in society is really important. There's this huge gradient. Those at the lower end are clearly sicker than those that are at the upper end. They consume many more health care resources. They tend to be sicker. Also, societies that have a greater economic and social inequity have worse health status overall. Mm-hmm. Those societies that have narrower range of economic inequality have better health. So when you look at the countries that have better health care, they do not have the extremes of wealth and poverty. The United States is right at the top of the list for having extremes of wealth and poverty. We have the richest people in the world, and we have some of not necessarily the poorest, but some of the very poor people. And it's that living close to each other and that lack of control that seems to affect one's health. Environmental exposures, we've kind of touched on that. Behavioral patterns, smoking, obesity, those things are clearly important to health. And finally, the 10% part, 10% or less, is the healthcare. I don't want to negate that's unimportant, because it is important. It certainly is important for anybody that falls down and breaks their ankle or breaks their leg or gets a bone sticking out through their leg because they were hiking up there at Copperdation and slipped and fell. In the absence of good health care, you're probably going to lose a leg. You may very well die. Whereas if you get reasonable health care, you're going to get that fixed and you're going to recover from that. So health care clearly plays an important role. But I think we tend to overemphasize the role of health care in health. And as a physician, that's really good, because people are going to come in and they're going to pay lots of money to me and to my colleagues to have things done that they may or may not need. So tonight, or tomorrow night, when we have this little session, if somebody wants to talk about prostate cancer or breast cancer screening or a lot of the screening and a lot of this kind of stuff that's going on, there's a lot of, and the technology that's gone into medicine, a lot of money to be made. Now I've gone way over my That's okay, Gay, up there to the board.
Is this the slideshow that we're doing?
No, we're not doing it. We're behind.
He told me to keep track of it. Make him do the slideshow at 11:15.
Okay. No, this is why is your doctor ever on time?
Talk fast.
Okay. What we have up here, we have some sample countries, and we have the gross domestic product, the capital gross domestic product, how much money each individual, the average person earns in that country. Then we have a life expectancy chart, which we're going to put in. We have a probability of dying under the age of 5. We have the probability of dying between the ages of 15 and 60. Now that is really an important number. in terms of health of the society. I mean, we don't want the 15 to 60 year old. Hey, you die after 60, you know, you're about ready to retire, you know. You're not contributing to a whole lot of society. No loss, you know.
It's like 70.
It's a little crazy.
And then we're going to look at how much we spend per capita on health care and the percentage of the GDP that is spent on health care. So we just kind of look at these numbers and just compare these countries. We've got the United States, we've got Great Britain, we got Canada, Japan, and Liberia. I've got Liberia because I spent some time in Liberia at a mission, actually a Lutheran-run mission, Phoebe Hospital. I don't know whether you know it, this back quite a while ago, before all the wars and civil wars in West Africa. But so we look at how much money. Well, where are the richest? $44,000 per capita. $33,000, it's amazing how the other industrialized countries kind of lump together. France is right around $33,000, Germany's $33,000, Canada's $36,000, Japan $32,000, Liberia $260. Not even $1,000 there. So that's they're a very poor country. Okay, life expectancy.
That's average or mean?
Average.
Average.
Average life expectancy, well, actually, we can give male and female. We'll give male and female. This would be life expectancy at birth. Okay, United States, what are we coming up with? Men, 75. Women, 80. Why is it?
Why so they can have 5 years of peace?
All right, well, let's look at the United Kingdom. Now, they have this horrible healthcare system which we hear people in Washington talk about, oh, it's terrible, terrible. You know, they wait in line, they don't get any health care. What do you think? How long do men live in Great Britain?
74.
77.
Damn it.
Women live to be 81. How about Canada? More or less in Great Britain?
More.
They live longer. They don't smoke as much in Canada. 78 and 83.
I'm moving.
How about Germany? How about Germany? 77 and 82?
You don't have Germany.
Oh, I don't have Germany. Japan, I'm sorry. Okay, you may all want to move to Japan. 79 and 86.
Wow.
So women live 6 years long. Of course, you can move to Japan, but if you're not Japanese, it doesn't work. Still going to knock you. And Liberia, 43 and 46. Now, just make a comment that when we talk about life expectancy in the United States, there are different populations in the United States. So if you're an inner-city black male, you have a life expectancy that's very similar at birth to Liberia. If you're an Asian woman in, I don't know why they did this, but it's Hoboken, New Jersey. You know, you are a woman has life expectancy like 89 years in the United States. Okay, probability of dying less than 5. USA, 8. This is 8 per 1,000.
It's a percentage?
No, just 8. 8 per 1,000. This is the number per 1,000. In the United Kingdom, it's 6. In Canada, it's 6. In Germany, it's 5.
We don't have Canada.
Oh, Germany, I have Germany. Germany and Japan are the same. That's why I kind of look. Japan's 4. And Liberia's 235. So one out of every five, a little more than one out of every five children in Liberia. These are data from 2006, which is the latest WHO data that we have. Probability of dying between 15 and 60, again, this is going to be males and females. For USA, 137 and 80. United Kingdom, 98 and 61. Canada, 89 and 55.
This is per 1,000?
This is per 1,000. Japan, 89 and 44. And Liberia, 498 over 415. I've thrown Liberia. Liberia is one of the poorest countries on the globe, and they just have horror. This is just to put it into kind of a perspective, but what we really are looking at industrialized and what we ought to be doing. But from a worldwide perspective, you know, we're so concerned about ourselves. And and there's people dying of preventable diseases. Expenditure per capita. Okay, USA's, and this is, again, this is 2006 data, so it's a little bit old. $6,714. That's what we pay per person for healthcare. United Kingdom, $2,784. Canada, I'll just round these out, $3,600. Germany, $3,300. Japan, $2,500. Liberia spends $39 per person on healthcare. And then as a percentage of the GDP, United States is 16%, UK is 8%, Canada is 10%, Japan is 8%, and Liberia is 6%. So Liberia spends a chunk of their gross domestic product on healthcare, but it's only, $39. United States spends not only double what everybody else spends, but it's double as a percentage of our gross domestic product. So if this were Consumer Reports doing a little, you know, they check rated, not acceptable, you know, Liberia would not be acceptable. I mean, that's just a horrible situation. They're doing the best they can under horrible circumstances, but you wouldn't want to get your health care in Liberia. You might not want to get your health care in the United States based on that either, because you're spending a lot of money and you're really not getting, I mean, it's like, it would be like comparing a Toyota Camry with a, I don't know, what's a junky American car, you know? a junky any kind, it's something, a car that's much more expensive but breaks down all the time, and doesn't get very good mileage, and so that's kind of what the United States is, that you're paying a lot and we don't have a lot to show for it. So that's just to kind of give you kind of a global overview, and yet you will hear over and over that the United States has the best healthcare system in the world. In fact, there's 50% of congressmen who are going to tell you that. Yeah. And that's why we shouldn't be changing things, because if we change it, we won't. Fulton Village is a great place, isn't it?
What's the population?
I don't like this guy. I am way behind that. We're going to fly, okay? Are you ready? It really is great. Okay. Who has the best health system? Not WHO, it's who. Who has the best healthcare system in the world? How do you measure? Do you measure, is it probability of dying? Is it life expectancy? Is it expenditures? Well, let's look. How do you define it? It's kind of hard to define. We certainly know who's got the most expensive one. We can kind of figure out who's got the longest life expectancy, the lowest infant mortality, who has universal coverage, who has accessibility, who has fairness. There's lots of different ways of looking at it, isn't it? And it's complicated. It's not easy. And so lots of different people tried to come up with ways. So let's say, how about just who spends the most? Well, we spend the most. We must have the best. We certainly spend the most. But maybe get back to one of those conclusions I mentioned before. Maybe you can spend too much on healthcare. If you're spending too much on healthcare and not enough on social services, if you're not spending enough on keeping your environment clean, if you're not spending enough on public safety, maybe it's self-defeat. I always digress. Everybody's heard of robotic surgery? This is fantastic stuff. This is the highest tech of the highest tech. Somebody could actually be doing, your surgeon, you could be having your prostate removed by a surgeon in Boston while you're out in Seattle. And we literally can do that. I mean, somebody's got to stick a couple tubes into you, but once they've done that, the surgeon can actually do this, run this console, and it's fantastic. These little things go around and they could just remove exactly the product, nothing else. This is great. It adds about $3,000. Now, usually the surgeon's in the operating room with you. They don't do it, but you literally could do it there. Adds $3,000 to the cost of the procedure. There's no evidence that anybody does any better. But boy, it's nice to talk about, and the surgeons, it's a toy. And we do it, and it's being adopted everywhere. I bet everybody here, in any size city at all, there's at least one robotic system set up. And they cost about $1.5 million to just just to set it up.
Billion or million?
Million.
Not billion.
I could have 1,000 robots. Yes. All right, anyway, so we spend the most. I may beat that into the ground. Okay, life expectancy. We have already looked at some of these numbers. Where's the United States? Oh. 38. That's embarrassing. I mean, are there any of the doctors here? Physicians? Nurses? Anybody in the healthcare profession should be embarrassed. this is embarrassing. We've allowed this to happen. 38. We're worse than Cuba. We're better than Portugal. But look at who's above us. So life expectancy at birth, let's not use that as a criterion, right? Let's use a different criterion. How about infant mortality? Oh, well, we're better. You know, we're not 38th, we're 22nd. But look at, we're more than double the infant mortality of the Scandinavian countries, Japan. You're going to see a certain number of countries appear on this list over and over. Japan, Scandinavian countries, France. How about disability adjusted life expectancy? This is called DALE. So this is a way of trying to look at, you know, it's not necessarily great to live to be 90 if you spent 20 years in a nursing home. Right?
Right.
You know, we're going to talk about this tomorrow. We're going to talk about longevity and life expectancy. And the oldest lady to ever live was this French lady from southern France. She died 122. I'll know tomorrow. I'll have my notes, but it's like 122 years old. Longest documented lady. She was totally deaf, totally blind, bedridden from arthritis, and probably demented, although she couldn't talk and couldn't see, so nobody quite knew how demented she was. And she lived to be 122, and she's spent the last 8 or 10 years of her life, you know, bedridden. I mean, it's like, is that really what we want? So this disability adjusted life expectancy is a way of saying, you know, that you have good quality life. And we kind of look at that, and we're way the heck down at 24. Now, I'm not blaming all this on the healthcare system because we said genetics, environment, a lot of other issues, but there's probably no reason for the United States to be as low as that. So WHO has come up with a system of ranking all the countries in the world on healthcare, and this is what WHO says. France, Italy, San Marino, and Andorra. I mean, I'm not even sure where they are. They're in Europe someplace, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody know where San Marino is? Sounds like it ought to be near Italy or something,
it's
right?
It's in California.
I think it's a different San Marino.
Okay. Anyway, United States, 37 on WHO. Now, they have a fairness criterion that carries a lot of weight. And that criterion, and what they look at and they say it depends on how equally rich and poor are treated within the country and how care is financed. United States comes out really badly on that because the rich get all kinds of good care in this country and the old. But the poor don't, or at least many of the poor don't. And health care is financed in a very unfair kind of way. So the WHO rankings are, you know, we don't come out very well. The Commonwealth Fund, I'm not familiar with this, it's an independent organization that kind of studies healthcare throughout the world and in the United States. They came up with a ranking. This is what they came. Again, there's a certain number of countries that keep appearing at the top of everybody's list. And the United States never appears at the top of everybody's list, or at least not these organizations that are highly respected. So let's look at an organization that may not be quite so highly respected. Newsweek. This issue is actually, it's in the library right there if anybody wants to look at it. This is August 30th, 2010. So this is 10 days old or 12 days old or whatever. They ranked the best country in the world. Now they looked at it from economy, freedom of enterprise, environment, a whole bunch of things. It's kind of an interesting article. And they ranked the top 10. So now we got the Americans that are doing this study now. Okay, so they ranked the top 10 countries for healthcare. Here we are. There we are. Where are we?
No, we're not there.
We didn't even make it. We didn't make it. Now, they didn't even put, I mean, they saved the embarrassment of listing all 100 countries or 200 countries, whatever it is, where they would have put us, but they didn't put us in the top 10, even Newsweek. All right. Well, he keeps showing up, doesn't he?
If you want to play your movie, you should play your movie.
What movie?
The one that you wanted me to stop you at 11:15 for.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, this is it.
Oh, this is it.
Yes.
That's
all right. All right, so this is a myth. The U.S. has the best system in the world. I hope we put that to rest. Does anybody here still believe in the United States has the best health care? Okay.
Boehner.
He hasn't heard me.
He better.
He won't listen. All right. Europe, and here's the other thing that you hear all the time. Europe, Canada, you know, all these, you know, France, we don't want to be like France or Germany, oh God. Europe, Canada, France, Germany, UK, the rest of the developed world, they have socialized medicine. We don't want socialized medicine with government-controlled providers, unhappy patients, long lines, miserable, that doesn't work. And these, and even if those systems were good, they're too foreign. We're Americans, you know. We discovered all kinds of stuff here. I mean, we have not only in medicine. You know, we got the first atomic bomb. We even made the first machine gun. I mean, we discovered lots of things in this country. You know? We're good at it, and so we really don't need any help from abroad. Now, this is where this book is so great. This T.R. Riegel, because he has traveled the world. He's kind of looked around, and so let's look at healthcare models and what we can learn from other countries. And this gets back to this thing about healthcare reform in this country and whether or not the Congress really accomplished anything and really addressed the issues that are going to make a difference in healthcare reform, which is going to promote health, which is going to promote a sense of total and complete, what was that again? The complete
total
well-being.
Well-being.
Total well-being is what we're trying to achieve. Or at least that's what I'd like to achieve for me. Right? We all want to do it for ourselves, but we also know it's the old thing that if large parts of our society are ill or unsafe or fearful, we're not going to be well and safe and fearful. The quality.
Fearless.
Fearless. Without fear. Okay, so we're really dependent. Our health is dependent on society as a whole. So let's look what other countries have done. And this is T.R. Riegel. Okay. There are four basic models of healthcare delivery. All the industrialized countries have chosen one of the first three. The out-of-pocket model is what takes place in Liberia and places like that. Okay, so we're going to look at Bismarck model, Beverly. Boy, it sure sounds European or something, doesn't it? Foreign. But anyway, I'm going to be able to explain what those four, three or four systems are, so that everyone here is going to understand that. So when you get into discussions about, well, when somebody tells you, like, you know, Germany's socialized medicine, we don't want to be like Germany, or we don't want to be like France, we don't want to be like Japan, you're going to find out that Germany's not at all like Great Britain. Germany's not really at all like Sweden. They have a very totally different healthcare system. But I suspect that most of us in this room think that, well, they must all have something that's all socialized, and because that's what you're going to hear from the demagogues in Washington, D.C., that are telling you that we can't change, that we don't want to change, that we've got the best system, and that if we mess with it, we're going to screw it all. Okay, here's the Bismarck model. Believe it or not, this is like 18, I don't know when it was. When was Bismarck? 1880? When he brought the German Republic, all the German states together and organized, and he founded the welfare state. And so in this model that really got started back then and which exists right now, both providers and payers are private entities. Well, boy, that doesn't sound very socialistic, does it? Insurance companies are private but nonprofit and cover everybody. Premiums are collected from employers and employees, and if you're not working, the government pays out of the general tax fund. but they pay it to a private insurance company. Now, there are 200 insurance companies in Germany. 200 separate insurance companies. When you go to work for Volkswagen or for Mercedes-Benz or whoever, they will have a company and you will get assigned to that company. You can change that company, but you start off with that particular company. That will be your choice. But if you don't like the way they're providing care for you or managing them, you can switch to a different company. The premiums are the same. The only difference is going to be on the service, how friendly that agent is when something on the telephone. So people don't switch a whole lot because they're very similar. They're all non-profit. All these agencies, all these insurance companies, they're private insurance companies, but they're non-profit. And they're regulated. All the physicians and hospitals are private entities. So they have private practices or little group practices, very much like the United States. But this marked regulation by the government in terms of what's going to be covered and what's going to be paid for and what the price is going to be. So you have all these, you have a lot of choice, but there's not much difference between one from the other. There may be minor things in service. So that's what the Bismarck model is, and it's present. Germany has it, Japan has it, France, Belgium, Switzerland have it. Private, Japan has 750 different insurance companies, but they all charge us, they all do the same thing. When you get a policy, you have this universal policy, and everybody in those countries are covered. So they have universal coverage.
Does the doctor you go to relate to the...
No, but you can go to any doctor you want. Any doctor you want in any city you want, because they're all covered under this one system. So France, you just go. Now, France has a system in which you get the bill from your doctor, you pay them in the office, you kind of write them a check right then and there, and then you get reimbursed. And France guarantees that you'll be reimbursed within 7 days of the time you submit your claim. And they pretty much keep to it. Yes, sir?
In, say, a country like Japan, could they improve the quality and delivery of their medical services at a lower cost if they all produce pretty much the same thing by simply eliminating a bunch of those competing bureaucracies for the medical care dollar? In other words, if you have 7 insurance companies, you have 700 insurance companies, you have 700 sets of redundant bureaucracies. Whereas if you could reduce it down to 5, you'd only have 5.
Yeah, you know, I think that would be right, but you know what it's like trying to get rid of bureaucracies. There's place, I'm sure there's place for savings in all these systems. And
I think how good they'd be if they did that.
Yeah, that's, I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I can't answer that. I just don't have the personal experience for that to be able to answer that question. Okay, so that's the Bismarck system. And so, remember, Germany, Japan, France, Belgium, those are the main countries that use that kind of system. Private insurance companies, private providers, government regulation. The Beveridge model. William Beveridge was a social reformer and really inspired the British National Health Service that gets attacked so much in our press. Healthcare is provided for and financed by the government through the general tax payments. This is true. This is socialized medicine, the way we think of socialized medicine. No medical bills. Medical care is a public service like the fire department or the library. So it comes out of the general tax revenues. Many clinics, but not all the clinics and hospitals, are owned by the government. And there's doctors that are both employed and private, employed by the government. Government controls everything. And so the costs are kept under control. And there's a lot of systems that use this. Great Britain, Italy, Spain, Scandinavian countries, Hong Kong, Cuba has a system just like this. And we have it in the Department of Veterans Affairs. So if you're a veteran and you're service-connected, anybody service-connected with a veterans here? If you are, you can go to a veterans hospital. You never see a bill, do you? You so you go to the Veterans Hospital, it's paid out of all of us paying income taxes to the government, that money is used, is funded. The doctors are all employed by the Veterans Administration, the Veterans Hospital facilities there. That would be a socialized kind of medicine. And so we have a piece of that here. But this is the beverage model. This is the socialized medicine, what we think of as being socialized medicine. Seems to work in a lot of countries. And many of those countries are listed right at the top when it comes down to whoever's listening, including Newsweek magazine, put Spain and Italy near the top as far as care. Okay, the National Health Insurance model. This is a different model. This is sort of a combination of both the Bismarck and Beveridge models. The providers are private, so the doctors and hospitals are private. The payer is a government-run insurance program that everybody pays into. And it has cost control by limiting services, negotiating lower fees. Canada is a primary example of this. We hear about the Canadian system. But the Canadian system is very different, obviously, because it's a single insurance company. Actually, it's each province has a, for you Canadians here, each province has its own insurance program. But they're all basically, Canada really has a provincial health insurance model, but every province has to have one. And it's universal coverage, single payer. And so Canada, Taiwan, South Korea have adopted that model. The providers are private. And of course, government can control the cost because it's the payer. Can anybody think of a system like this in the United States? Any of you?
Oh, Medicare.
Medicare, is it? There you go. Medicare. Government-run insurance program, but it doesn't apply to everybody, does it? It only applies to people over 65 or people who've been disabled on Social Security disability. But that's the system. That's the system that Canada has. That's the system that Taiwan has adopted and that South Korea has adopted. Now the out-of-pocket model. Only the developed industrialized nations. It's interesting that Hong Kong being a little bit separate, but Taiwan and South Korea now have moved into the category of developed industrialized nations, where 25 years ago they weren't considered that. But only the developed nations have an established healthcare payment system. Most nations are too poor. Liberia is an example. I mean, Liberia has no national health system of any kind. The rich in those countries get poor. The rich get care, the poor stay sick. Medical care is available to the well-to-do or well-connected. Rural care is largely unavailable. And care is paid for by the patient or the patient's family or friends or whatever to develop that. So in Cambodia, 91% of the care is out of pocket provided. There will be some international companies and some big companies that will have their own insurance programs in some of the third world countries, and some of the government employees will be certainly the high people in the government will have some kind of government insurance. In Great Britain, as an example, 3% of the population goes outside the National Health Service for their care. Almost every country allows, if you've got money, if you're rich, you can buy care in a parallel system somewhere. There'll be a private hospital that will take care of you. Even in Great Britain or in Scandinavia, there will be some private hospitals. Or if you can get on an airplane, fly to the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and get taken care of. So there's always gonna be that sort of that safety valve for those people who have the resources and want to spend those resources on themselves. In the United States, about 17% of all healthcare dollars are out of pocket. The rest are paid for either through an insurance plan or by the government programs, the veterans, the Indian Health Service, whatever. Okay, so four models. Beveridge model, that was the Beveridge model was the Great Britain model, which is this kind of the true socialized medicine. Is the Bismarck model with private health insurers, but they're nonprofit. and the private providers. There's the national health insurance model that Canada has and that Medicare has, and there's the out-of-pocket. So these four models, we ought to be able to understand them because we have all of them in one form or another in this country. Convoluted national healthcare system, non-system, apparatus we call it. So we have all pieces of this. Okay, if you're a working person under the age of 65, you're German or France or Japan. It's a standard Bismarck model. You know, you work for Hewlett Packard, you have a health insurance program paid for by your government. The employer and the worker shares the premium. The insurer pays most of the bills to private providers. It's the same thing as that you would have in Germany or Japan. If you're a Native American, or you're in the military, or a veteran, you might as well be in Cuba or Great Britain. You're really in a socialized medical system. Government employees are the providers. You don't get a bill. Government funds pay for your health care. If you're over 65, you're Canada. You were right on with that. So the U.S. Medicare is a national health insurance system. And even the Republicans, and even, I shouldn't say that. That's terrible. I apologize. But people who have opposed and stand up, we can't have national health, don't touch Medicare.
Right.
We're not going to touch Medicare. In fact, everybody, Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter who you are, you're a defender of Medicare in Congress, right? I mean, nobody dares because people over 65. And yet they'll badmouth national health insurance. They'll say how awful it is, and evil. We certainly can't extend it to somebody who's 64, right? I mean, that would be horrible. That would be Armageddon. Anyway, we're going to move. We have 1 minute. Okay. And for the 45 million people in this country, your neighbors, you're Cambodia or India or Liberia, you have to pay out of your pocket if you can, unless you're really sick. One thing about this country, nobody dies on the street. Nobody's going to bleed to death out there because the hospital has to take you in. I mean, that's the Congress won't pay. So a poor person gets run over by a truck out there. The hospital can't say, and that person has no money, no resource. The hospital can't say, well, don't come in here. We don't, you can't pay like they might do in Liberia. This country, we have a law that says you have to take this person in and provide them with high quality care. But the government says you have to do it, but the government won't necessarily pay one penny for it.
Can I ask if there was a question?
No.
Why would I ask a question?
Sorry.
Okay, I'm winding this thing up, and I will stick around into lunch hour for questions to anybody. It says we're like no other country because we maintain so many separate systems for separate. We break everybody into different. We were talking about that this morning on the Bible study about whether we're being exclusionary or inclusionary in terms of bringing everybody in. Well, we divide everybody up into different groups. Every other country settled on a single model for them. Nobody's done what we did. Nobody in the right mind would do what we did. And so the common principles, unified system applies to everybody, nonprofit financing, universal coverage. You've got to do those things. So what have we done with the healthcare reform? We are moving in the direction of universal coverage. That's all we've done. We don't have a unified system yet. We certainly don't have nonprofit financing. We're going to continue to have insurance companies taking off anywhere from 10 to 30% of the healthcare dollar going to the bureaucracy of the insurance company. And they're going to be competing with each other. So is there a lesson for us? Yeah, we don't have a healthcare system. We really don't. And again, healthcare system, just 10% of what comes to health. We want health. We don't necessarily want healthcare. We want health. This is one piece of getting there. And because we're fragmented and broken up and all this for-profit stuff and who's paying the bills and anybody's been to the doctor and getting these bills, you can't make sense of it, can you? It's just, there's all these numbers and the charges and what Medicare allows and, it's unbelievable. It's inherently, we've developed a medical care system, which is complicated, expensive, and unfair. Okay, healthcare reform tweaks at the edges, doesn't do anything about the underlying convoluted apparatus. We really have to, look at those systems, those three systems. We have a little bit of each of them, and which makes sense, which direction we're going to head. But to say that we can't learn from the other developed countries, that we have to keep this convoluted mess forever and ever, is insanity, especially when we see what it's doing to our economy, and everybody knows that it's unsustainable. It is absolutely unsustainable. Okay, the answer, we need a major overhaul. Despite what its critics argue, the ACA, what was the Affordable Care Act, that was the one that Obama signed, is not an overhaul, much less it's certainly not a takeover of healthcare by the government. I mean, it's not a takeover at all. You can't, and we need universal coverage, elimination of the for-profit insurance plans, and some kind of comprehensive evidence-based cost-effective medicine. Okay, Jay said I can take questions. We ran over by 5 minutes?
Not that bad
for me. But I didn't let you guys talk very much. And so I promise, tomorrow...
Is this a politician?
But... All right. Well, wait till you see what Don does when you go to his lectures, you know. So anyway, thank you for your attention. As I said, we'd be tomorrow we're going to talk about aging. I'll be available tomorrow evening. I'll be around. I drink coffee. I love to talk. I love to listen to people. Mostly I love to talk. But anyway, we can share some ideas. We're going to go, as we go on this week, we're going to get into religion and medicine. That really is fascinating stuff. And ethics and end-of-life issues. We can talk about everything from physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, terminal sedation, all these kinds of things that are getting us onto slippery slopes, perhaps, or whether they're really allowing patient autonomy. And in some cases, it's very upsetting and disconcerting to people and their belief systems, and for other people, it's liberating. So we really have some fascinating kinds of things that are happening in medicine, and I'm happy you're all, not too many people left to enjoy the sunshine, but